The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Stephen Kinzer and Trudy Rubin.
This is rather an elegant thing. I just want to check if it works. Can you hear me in the back? Okay, excellent. Well, I think there's never been as interesting a time to be talking about Iran since the 1979 revolution, and I think we have the perfect guest to be doing so. Closer? Okay. All right. We have the perfect guest to be doing so, Stephen Kinzer. You are probably familiar with his first, or maybe it isn't his first, but with his first book on Iran, All the Shah's Men, about the overthrow of the elected and democratically chosen Prime Minister of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, in 1953. This was a seminal event that shaped Iranian views of the United States from the generation that was of age then up until the present. It's something that's always referred to. And even though there were other factors in the overthrow of Mossadegh, even though, for example, religious fundamentalists, Ayatollahs, collaborated in the coup, and might well have tried to foment one if the CIA hadn't gotten there first, and were very happy to see it, and now will never admit that. Despite all that, the events of 1953 shape present Iranian views and are extremely important because that event, that coup, speaks to the question of how the United States should and can relate to Iran today, how it can relate to a democratic opposition without appearing to be in the business of regime change, and what it is exactly that the U.S. should be doing in regard to that opposition. If we fast forward to today, and you're aware of all the events that have been going on since the rigged election, let me mention a new book that's coming out by Stephen Kinzer, because I think that relates to the way we have to look forward as to how to deal with Iran. The new book is called Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. And Stephen argues in that book that Turkey and Iran are our logical partners in the Middle East in the 21st century. But how do we get to that point where they are our logical partners? I mean, when I think of my last trip to Iran, which was in 2006, practically everybody I interviewed is either in jail or has somehow managed to get out. A student leader, Abdullah Momeni, in prison. Ayatollah Khalaji, I went to see to speak of whether he believed that Shiites could bring their Mahdi back by starting a war, the charge that many people bring up about Ahmadinejad, that religiously he may think that by starting a war with Israel he could bring back the Mahdi. I went to see this Ayatollah. He told me in great detail that this was against the Shiite faith. He was just thrown in jail with his whole family last week, not, I think, because of this take on theology, but because he was close to liberal Ayatollahs who have become disgusted with the behavior of President Ahmadinejad. So if you take these two books of Stephen's, starting on the one hand with All the Shah's Men and the overthrow of Mossadegh, and then coming to the future, can we be a partner with Iran and Turkey in reshaping a more, or not reshaping, in participating with a democratic Iran and a democratic Turkey in bettering the Middle East? What I want to discuss today is how can we get from that point, a black mark, to that future in which we hope that after decades of awful, sour, and destructive relations between us and Iran, there might be a chance to become an ally. So let me just start by asking, Stephen, could you just frame this with a little bit of history from the Mossadegh period? Do you think that still colors the relationship today, or has the younger generation moved beyond that and perhaps is looking at the United States in a different way?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me here, and it's a great honor to be with one of the few journalists in America that really focuses on these issues. It's a great frustration for those of us that are interested in that part of the world that we really don't see any resonance out there in the mainstream media, and Trudy is really a shining example of this, so it's really an honor and a thrill to be up here with you. Thank you. You're very lucky here in Philadelphia. Most cities do not have any reporter, anything like what Trudy is and what Trudy does.
Thank you.
History weighs very heavily on Iranians. First of all, they have so much of it. Iran is about 10 times older than the United States, and Iranians really do have a sense of this. When we try to treat them like Paraguay or Burundi or something, they get their back up. They begin to think, oh, who are you that just arrived on the world scene to come here and shake a finger at us? And when Europeans were still living in caves and wearing animal skins, you know, the Persians were looking at the stars and writing poetry and discovering geometry and algebra. So they have a very strong sense of who they are and who they've been in the world. In the more recent history, history of the last, say, 200 years, themes of betrayal and dispossession have run very deeply in the Iranian consciousness. Iran is a country that has been repeatedly humiliated. It has been occupied. It has lost territory. Foreign powers have ripped it apart, and for years and decades were taking everything that was valuable out of Iran. The sense that the whole world is dedicated to preventing us from progressing is very strong in the Iranian collective consciousness. And if you look back in Iranian history, you can see how they got to this point of view. During the 19th century, of course, the British and the Russians treated Persia as a kind of a theater for their big power confrontation. At the beginning of the 20th century, they divided Iran between them at a conference in St. Petersburg that no Iranian attended or was even aware was happening. There were large portions of Iranian territory that became part of the Caucasus. They went to Russia. Herat, what is now western Afghanistan, of course, was part of Iran, and the language that's spoken there, Dari, is the same language that people in Iran speak. So this is a very important theme in the Iranian general consciousness. The world has tried to intervene to prevent us from developing. They wouldn't let us have our oil. They wouldn't let us have a steel mill. Over and over, you see examples of this. And these are played up very strongly in Iran and in the minds of most Iranians. Actually, I think many Iranians see the world's effort to prevent Iran from becoming a nuclear power in this context. It's just the latest example of how they don't want us to have modern technology and science and progress. Now, the Mossadegh episode, I think, is a very powerful one. Here they had a leader who nationalized the oil industry and wanted to turn the profits from oil to the benefit of Iranians. Outside powers intervened to prevent that from happening. I think, however, that that the role of the United States in Iran is a very interesting one. For the whole first half of the 20th century, the only Americans that ever came to Iran were people that wanted to help. Most of them were missionaries. They were school teachers. They were principals like Samuel Jordan, who built the fantastic Alborz College. They built the American Hospital in Tehran, which was the only place where a poor person could really get good medical treatment in Iran. A school teacher from Nebraska, Howard Baskerville, was the great martyr of the Constitutional Revolution. He was killed in 1909 while defending parliamentary democracy in Iran. Later on, when Parliament wanted to establish its power and try to push the British and Russians out of Iran, they hired another American, Morgan Schuster, to become the Treasurer General of their country and try to impose tax laws throughout the country. These were hugely popular figures. The United States had a really pure, almost, I'd say, over-idealized image in the minds of most Iranians. America was sort of like the perfect country. It was a country that had emerged just the way Iran wanted to emerge, by overthrowing the British and establishing our own national regime that would put our own interests first. Therefore, it was quite a shock, I think, to many Iranians, that the United States would be so directly involved in overthrowing the most nationalistic and democratic regime that Iran ever had. I want to tell one little story, this won't take too much time, that I think reflects how that episode has played out. We know now that one of the reasons, I think the main reason why America and Iran have been at odds for so long is emotions. Americans are really angry at Iran. The hostage crisis and everything that's happened in the last 30 years has given the United States plenty of good reason to be angry at Iran. Iran also has plenty of good reason to be angry at the United States. Not long ago, I spoke at an event in Washington in which one of the panelists was Bruce Langen. He was the chief American diplomat at the time the hostages were taken. So he was the senior hostage. Later on, we corresponded a little, and he told me a fascinating story. We in America, who can remember the hostage crisis, I remember we're quite baffled by it. It just seemed proof that Iran had been taken over by total nihilists who, for no reason at all, wanted to strike out in horrific ways against people that hadn't done anything wrong to them. Here's the story Bruce Langen told me that really made me realize how it looked from the other side. He had been in jail for over 400 days. He was in a little stone cell. One day the cell door opened, and it was one of his jailers, one of the hostage taker leaders. And the guy tried to speak, but Bruce Langen, so angry with all the resentment that had built up in him over more than a year in a cell, started screaming at this guy and said, "You have no right to do this. This is totally wrong. You're holding innocent people hostage. You can't do this. This violates every law of God and man, and it violates Iranian traditions." And he said, I went on and on for several minutes until I finally ran out of breath. And he said, finally, the guy leaned in at me and in very good English said, "You have no right to complain because you took our whole country hostage in 1953. So then Langen told me, I began to realize, flashback to 1953, what happened? Iranian people had a rebellion. The Shah was forced to flee. But CIA agents working in the basement of the U.S. embassy organized a coup, and they brought the Shah back, and the result was 25 years of dictatorship. Now flash forward, it's 1979. They're thinking, okay, we've thrown the Shah out again, the same Shah. We fear CIA agents working in the basement of the U.S. embassy will organize a coup and bring him back in order to prevent history from repeating itself. We had to do this. But, of course, most Americans had no idea this episode had ever happened. I do sense, however, that in recent years in particular, the young generation growing up in Iran, despite all of this history, sees America in a very positive way. I think Iran is the only country in the Islamic world where the majority of the population is pro-American. Part of the reason is that the United States and the Iranian regime don't get along, and most Iranians don't like their regime. Another reason, I think, is that Iranians admire democracy. What they have sacrificed in these last 6 months is astonishing. I wonder how many Americans would be willing to take the risks that Iranian young people have taken in these last 6 months. So I think we inspire them, and I hope they will also inspire us.
One of the things that has fascinated me when I have talked to Iranians in Iran, and also when I've talked to dissidents who've left more recently, some of the most active opposition figures are people who were part of that revolution, even people who were among the hostage takers. Mm-hmm. And they have revised their view. Obviously, time has passed, and they look back, and some of them have said openly they wish that the hostage taking hadn't happened that way. And, in fact, none of the students ever thought it was going to last more than a few days. It got caught up in internal Iranian politics, and that's why it went on and on. So, again, if you flash forward to now, what do you think people in the opposition expect from us now? The mantra has been all these years that we should not meddle in Iranian politics. And, of course, under the Bush administration, there was overt talk of regime change. And when I was last there in 2006 and talking to a well-known student leader who's now in prison, he said, you know, help us by making the internet work better, giving us some cell phones, but don't talk about regime change, don't give our groups money, and don't make problems for us. So if you look at the situation now with the legacy of 1953, what should the U.S. be doing, if anything, to help the opposition, or should we be standing back in order not to resurrect concepts of U.S. meddling in Iranian politics?
The latter. It's unfortunate that Iranian history, particularly history of the last half century, has cast the United States in the role of the meddling outsider. Any group or individual in Iran that is embraced and promoted by the United States becomes stigmatized. Our encouragement is the kiss of death. There are very few countries in the world where being supported actively by the United States would be as harmful to you as they would be in Iran. I think President Obama, I think, has struck pretty much the right tone. He has expressed his admiration for the democratic movement, but he hasn't been out banging the drum every day and talking about how they're all heroes and the Iranian regime is awful and it's all got to collapse and this will never go on any longer and we're just waiting for the day right around the corner when the revolution will come in Iran. That will only make things worse in Iran. Foreign intervention has been a curse in Iran for more than 200 years. As the United States emerges as a promoter of one faction or one project in Iran, Iranians place this in a historical context. That delegitimizes what I consider to be one of the most legitimate opposition movements in the world. It's a little frustrating for Americans, but in a way maybe it's educational for us. You know, there are a lot of things in the world that are not up to us to change, that are not up to us to do. Forces in the world unfold in the fullness of time. We would love to see things happen as we would like, but the world has its own dynamic. I tell you, the political evolution of Iran is not over. There are essentially three paradigms of possible government in Iran, if you look at history. One is religious rule. One is military-backed dictatorship. And the other is liberal democracy. Well, we've now had about 30 years of religious rule. Before that, we had 25 years of military-backed dictatorship. If there's a cycle, I like to think I can see what's coming. I wouldn't dare to predict how that's going to happen or when it's going to happen. But I would say this. Here's a lesson that Iranians have probably learned more bitterly than any people in the world. And I've had so many Iranians tell me this. Last time I was in Iran, which was before this latest round of protests, I decided I'd ask just about every Iranian I met this same question. So, you don't like your regime? And I think at least maybe two-thirds of the people would probably agree with that. So why don't you do something about it? Why don't you have a revolution? Why aren't you out there on the streets demanding the overthrow of the whole system? And almost every single person I met had the same answer. They said, oh, we tried that. Yeah, we know about revolutions. In 1979 or 78, we all united, people that hated each other, religious fundamentalists, Mossadegh-style liberals, all people of communists, people of all sorts, we all united to overthrow the Shah. Even though we disagreed with each other and we had no idea what was coming next, we all agreed on one very obvious truth, which was that whatever is going to happen next, it's got to be better than what we have now. Well, boy, did we learn a lesson. And the lesson is, no matter how bad things are, it can always get worse. So I think the attraction of overnight revolution and wiping the slate clean is greater when you're further away. When you're actually there, I think you see a lot of the dangers of that. And therefore, I think, although I personally am overwhelmingly impressed with what has developed out of the democratic movement in Iran in recent months, that's their business. It's not our business.
Just to ask you one question about their business, how would you define what is going on there now, given your knowledge of history? Do you see it as pre-revolutionary? If you read the blogs that are coming out of Iran, if you read, for any of you who are really interested in Iran, you might not know about one of the best websites that collates just about everything that's coming out and translates things. It's called enduringamerica.com. And if you really want to follow what's happening, go to enduringamerica.com. And the latest buzz in this past week is that there seem to be some signs that two of the sort of leaders of the opposition, Mr. Mousavi and Mr. Karoubi, are toying with the idea of compromise. They are making statements which, while they don't recognize Ahmadinejad, indicate that they might be looking for a compromise with the supreme leader. So there's all this speculation. Will all these young people who are networking be willing to accept compromise? Has the opposition gone beyond compromise? Is it destined for a crackdown? So how would you define where it is?
Well, first of all, I think the reason why the regime in Iran responded to the protests so harshly, and it's the reason why many regimes respond the same way to protests, is that it works. Repression works. It doesn't work forever, but it's a very effective tool. And I think it's been very effective in Iran. I do think the government has lost a great deal of its moral legitimacy. And this is particularly important in the Shiite context. I used to live in Turkey. Sunni clergy in Turkey is very subservient to the state, has to do with their Ottoman background. Shiite clergy traditionally wasn't like that. In Shiite belief, justice is a hugely important concept. And when governments are seen to be drifting away from justice, they lose their moral legitimacy. Many Iranians, I think, feel that just the mullahs being in power at all was a betrayal of Shiite principles, that the mullahs are always supposed to be on the outside. They're not supposed to be collaborating with power. I do see that there are splits within the ruling group now. I think it is possible that that could lead to some kind of a compromise. I sometimes wonder if the mullahs might even decide to throw Ahmadinejad over in order to save their regime. And I could see that as a possibility. And maybe that's one of the incentives for people like Mousavi to be kind of maneuvering this way. I wouldn't say this is necessarily bad. Sometimes a peaceful transition to a halfway acceptable state is better than a violent explosion in the hopes of getting to a really good state. You're absolutely right about the internet in Iran. The internet culture is huge. Beneath the placid, kind of repressed surface of Iranian life, there's tremendous vitality, there's tremendous connection to the outside world. I think this is feeding a sense among many Iranians, particularly younger Iranians, that we've been unjustly turned into a pariah in the world, and it's not right that a country with such a rich tradition should have this position in the world. So I could see some kind of an evolutionary change. I don't see the current regime staying in power as it is for a long period of time, whether that means it will be replaced by new individuals or a new regime, or whether those individuals will just evolve or change or compromise. I couldn't say, but I do think there's a tremendous consciousness of what's happening in the outside world. This is not an isolated dictatorship like, for example, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which I also visited. I just, as one example of this, I have a friend who traveled to Iran not long ago with Sean Penn, and he told me this story that they were in the bazaar in Isfahan going from one stall to another, and they were at this one stall where an old guy and his young grandson were working, and they talked for a couple of minutes, and then they were walking away. As they were walking away, the young boy who spoke English called out, and he said, "Excuse me, can you come back here? My grandfather has a question for you." So they walked back, and then the young boy spoke with his grandfather for a couple of minutes in Persian to figure out what the question was. And then he turned to them and said, "My grandfather says he'd like to know, what was it like being married to Madonna?" I didn't even know Sean Penn was married to Madonna. So this is a group that's very tied into what's happening in the world, and I think that's one of their greatest assets.
Well, President Obama came to office pledging engagement mm-hmm. with Iran, and this was really a point of principle. In fact, it was something that he and Hillary Clinton argued over in the primaries, whether one should talk to the leader of Iran. And then candidate Obama sort of backed off and said, no, he was going to engage with the government, not necessarily with Ahmadinejad. And in fact, one of the first things he did on taking office was to send a letter to the supreme leader, because the new administration decided it made more sense to get in contact with the real power, supposedly the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. How do you see the engagement policy? From reading what you wrote, you seemed enthusiastic at first. How do you evaluate it up until now, and is it a course that really is likely to yield any results at this point, given the divisions inside Iranian society today?
We are not engaging with Iran. We are not offering to engage with Iran. All our present policy is to negotiate with Iran on the nuclear issue. This is a guaranteed no starter. This is a guaranteed failure. There's no incentive for Iran to give away the biggest card in their hand just as a tool to get to negotiations. A negotiation process that has a prospect of success is one in which both sides lay out their grievances. You cannot just expect Iran to negotiate on the one issue that we're interested in before you can also offer Iran that we will also talk about the issues you're interested in. So until we make an offer for comprehensive, direct, bilateral, unconditional negotiations, we're not going to get anywhere. The idea that we're going to be able to force Iran to abandon its nuclear program without a larger agreement, I think, is absolutely hopeless. There's no incentive for them to do that. In order to get any country to make a security concession, which is what we want Iran to make, that country has to feel safe. No country will make security concessions unless it feels safe. And unless there's a larger security architecture in which Iran is brought to feel safer, there's no incentive for Iran to give up its nuclear program. So I don't think we've tested Iran. Whether this regime would be open to negotiations or able to make an agreement for ideological or political reasons is a very open question. I think it would be foolish not to try. What I'd like to see is a combination of two examples. Let me just cite two historical examples. One is the way the United States broke the ice with China in the 1970s. The first document that came out of the U.S.-China rapprochement was something called the Shanghai Communique. So there were no agreements in the Shanghai Communique. That came later. It was just a very simple, actually quite a brilliant idea for a beginning of a diplomatic engagement. It just had three short parts. The first part was written by the Chinese side. That, although in the English version, the American part came first. Very clever. So the Chinese side writes everything we don't like about what America does and what we'd like America to change. Second is written by the American side, everything we don't like about China and what we'd like them to change. And the third part is a promise on both sides to negotiate all the above issues and not resort to force. So essentially, it's an agreement on an agenda. I think that would be the way to start. Let's sit down and figure out all the issues that you care about and all the issues that we care about, and we promise to negotiate them. Now, the one danger with such a negotiation that we absolutely must avoid is you can't get into this paradigm we've gotten into too often in the world, and that is make an agreement between the ruling elite of one country and the ruling elite of another country that turns its back on the people. This is the paradigm we have followed, particularly in the Middle East, and it's been very harmful to our interests because it turns large populations against us when they see us allied with regimes that they don't like. So the other piece of this that I'd like to see, if the Shanghai Communique would be one, would be something modeled on the Helsinki Accords. Those were agreements that were actually considered great victories by both sides. The Soviets thought this was a great victory because the Helsinki Accords recognized their legitimacy and their authority, but the West also saw that these accords included provisions to protect the human rights of all the people in Eastern Europe, and they actually set in motion processes that had very profound historical effects. I believe that the United States is not going to get anywhere with Iran unless we agree to broaden the agenda and truly have a full negotiation, not just on the issue we care about. I think what holds America back, as I said earlier, is emotion. Emotion is always the enemy of wise statecraft. The purpose of diplomacy is to promote national interests. And one of the great tragedies of our long estrangement from Iran is that it has harmed our own national interests by keeping us apart from a country that in many ways has some strategic interests in common with our own, and secondly, is a country whose society is very democratic and therefore has much more in common with our society than the societies of our so-called allies like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and all these places where women can't drive and rule has come down from a hereditary king. So I think there might be a prospect for progress through negotiation with Iran. Whether it could happen with this regime as it's presently constituted, I don't know, but I'd sure like to try.
Well, let me ask you two questions about that issue of trying for a grand bargain. One about talking with the political elite, the regime, and the other about dealing with the people. If I start with the people part, there have been a lot of reports from people who are in touch with opposition, young people, groups, opposition figures inside Iran, that there is a fear that if the United States does some kind of a deal with the regime, it will enshrine this regime, it will increase its power. Ahmadinejad will say, effectively, well, I got the deal that the moderates couldn't. And in fact, it looked like a couple of months ago there was actually going to be a compromise on the nuclear issue, and Ahmadinejad's negotiator had agreed to it. But when he came back to Tehran, the opposition to Ahmadinejad helped puncture it because they didn't want Ahmadinejad to get the credit for a compromise. So you have these internal dynamics, and would it appear, if we did make a deal with Ahmadinejad and he could get the backing of Khamenei and the powers that be, that we had turned our back on democracy once again, and 20 years from now they would look back on this as effectively what we did with Mossadegh, stabbing democracy in the back.
It's true that there are ayatollahs on both sides who see that it's in their interest that this negotiation not succeed. There are powerful forces on both sides that would not like to see the rapprochement. The Iranian opposition is in a very difficult position. They don't really have any good options. The best of the bad options would be for the regime somehow to be enticed or brought out of its isolation, brought into contact with the world and into a community of nations in which dissent and public debate are considered positive aspects of society. I think that a compromise between the United States and Iran might not necessarily be undermining the interests of democracy. It might in the long run promote those interests. I'd say this. We have not heard anything from the Iranian opposition that is directly urging the United States or the West, isolate this regime. Don't talk to them. If we start to hear that, then I think we have to reconsider the option of negotiation. But again, I think the opposition inside Iran is much more realistic than some of the millenarians in Washington who have been shaping American policy in recent years. I think they realize the ideal, or they can imagine the ideal Iran they'd like to see, but they also realize that's not going to happen overnight. So what would be the steps that could help us get there? I repeat, any agreement between the United States and Iran that does not take into account the interests of the people in Iran who are bravely supporting what we like to call American ideals would be completely unacceptable. Nonetheless, I don't think it's necessarily true that you'd have to make a choice, that if you're going to make a deal with the Iranian regime as it now stands, you're automatically turning your back on and stomping on the democratic opposition. I really don't see that as a dichotomy. It might turn out that way in the end, but I could also imagine a scenario under which an agreement could be reached with this regime or some form of this regime that would actually seem like a positive step forward for the democratic movement in Iran, which I think probably represents the majority of people in Iran. However, this democratic movement does not have a clearly defined goal. It's a very diffuse movement. Some want some kinds of moderate change. Some want more broader change inside the Islamic Republic structure. Only a limited number, nobody really knows how big that number is, would like to see the entire Islamic regime wiped away. So this is a very diffuse group of people who know what they don't like, but are not quite sure what they want. So I feel that there is a general sense in that movement that if the United States, through contacts with the regime, can somehow calm the regime down, calm some of its fears and its hostility, and bring it out of its isolation, that might be a very positive step, not just for regime-to-regime relations, but also for the people of Iran.
Well, looking at it from the other side, from the side of the regime, the China analogy often comes up here, and you've mentioned it yourself, that one should have a structure, a paper, layout principles. But if one looks back at Kissinger and Nixon going to China, it's very clear now that the Chinese knew what they wanted. They had a coherent regime that had made a decision, a hard-headed decision, that they wanted to restart relations with the United States as a hedge against the Soviet Union, which they felt was a greater threat. They had made up their minds, and they were pursuing a considered strategy. Do you feel that when you look at the Iranian side, that there is any such decision? Because it seems so unclear or it seems so clear, actually, that they have not made up their minds. They are not hedging against a greater threat in the background. We are the threat. And I remember when I was there in 06, and that's before all of this Sturm und Drang, I spoke with a senior person on their National Security Council who was a very senior Revolutionary Guards person, and he said with great conviction, "You need us more than we need you. If you want stability in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, you need us." I think he overestimated what Iran could deliver. But I'm just wondering what you think of the mindset in Iran and whether you think it's possible to get a coherent decision, even if the Obama administration was willing to offer a grand bargain.
Well, you raise a very valid point. I don't think the Iran regime has any more coherence these days than the Iranian opposition movement. The opposition movement really doesn't know what it wants, and the government really doesn't know what it wants either, because the government is made up of all sorts of different factions, like the opposition movement. And there will be losers in Iran if there's a rapprochement between the United States and Iran. A lot of people are making a lot of money, including many of the Revolutionary Guard leaders, as you know, from the sanctions regime and from this whole climate of hostility. So there will be factions in Iran, just like there will be factions in the United States that would fight against this. So, no, I don't believe there is a coherent regime that has a clear idea of what it wants. Nonetheless, that's not necessarily bad for us. I actually think that if the United States were to make a very serious offer for a global engagement, that might actually intensify splits within the regime. I think it would set off all sorts of debates inside Tehran, inside the regime. Now, is this a good thing for us? Is it a bad thing? Is it a trap? Shall we go for it? And if it's going to split the regime and increase debate inside the regime, maybe that's not a bad thing. Let me make one other point. I'll make an analogy with another country other than China. When you look at a map of the Middle East, one thing that becomes very clear to you right away is Iran is the big country right in the middle. So I'm going to give you an analogy after World War II. When you look at a map of Europe, Germany is the big country right in the middle. And Germany, at that time, right after World War II, looked in one way very much like Iran does now, which is it's a country that's nothing but trouble. They have been causing trouble for so long and fomenting insecurity. All kinds of problems are emanating from that country. So what do we do? And, of course, these are two countries, Germany 1945 and Iran today, that evoke great anger in the outside world, great emotion. So the first impulse of the United States in dealing with post-war Germany was what some of you may remember, the Morgenthau Plan. So the Morgenthau Plan was Germany will be cut into pieces, it will not be allowed ever again to have a factory, and it will have to live entirely off agriculture. And that was the policy of the U.S. government for several months until wiser heads prevailed, and we went the other direction, which was the Marshall Plan. Let's try to embrace Germany. Let's try to integrate Germany into Europe, something that nobody had imagined before. And sure enough, that has been one of the most spectacular successes of the modern era. Germany is now a creator of security, not a creator of insecurity. Now, let's take that example and move it to Iran. Putting aside emotions and what we would like to see in an ideal world, the fact is that almost none of the principal American objectives in the Middle East is possible without Iran. What does the United States want to see in the Middle East? We'd like to see an end to the Israel-Palestine problem. We'd like to see a democratic and stable Iraq. We'd like to see a lessening of nuclear competition. We would like to see a stable Lebanon. If you want to go a little further afield, we'd like to see a stable Afghanistan. None of these objectives can be achieved without Iran. Iran is what politicians would call a spoiler. If they're not in, they're going to ruin it. I remember a pithy phrase from Lyndon Johnson, who, having grown up on a farm, always had clever, a little bit shocking ways of reducing politics down to the barnyard level. And when he reappointed J. Edgar Hoover as head of the FBI, despite all of Hoover's dubious background, he was asked why he did this, and he said, this is a direct quote, "It's probably better to have him inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in." Maybe that wouldn't be the way I'd like to start my negotiating sessions with the Iranians. But the fact is, putting aside emotions and just looking coolly at our long-term national interest, we need a partnership with Iran. Iran is the passionate enemy of radical Sunni movements like the Taliban and al-Qaeda. When we were still embracing the Taliban and a Taliban delegation was in Texas negotiating for the Unocal pipeline, Iran was already fighting the Taliban. So we have much in common strategically with Iran. This is why I think there are two fundamental reasons for this engagement, why it would make sense over the long run. One is we have long-term strategic interests in common, and the other is our societies have so much in common because Iran has been working towards democracy for 100 years. And one lesson we have learned from Iraq is that democracy cannot emerge overnight. Countries that have had 100 years of practice with voting and constitutions and democracy are fertile grounds for the kind of society that we'd like to see created in the Middle East. So you're absolutely right that there is a layer of repression that makes this very difficult now. But we should certainly do nothing now that will endanger the possibility in the long run of taking advantage of the pro-American sentiment in Iran, which is a huge strategic asset for us.
Well, that brings me to the last thing that I wanted to ask you before we open it up to questions on the floor, which is we see that the Obama administration seems to be headed in the direction of targeted sanctions, if they can get them. Crippling sanctions, the phrase of Hillary Clinton, do not seem possible because of likely Chinese opposition, if not Russian. So, firstly, what do you think would be the impact, if that's where this all winds up, with more sanctions and a sort of frozen negotiating process? And then secondly, what would be the consequence if someone, us or Israel, bombed Iran?
First of all, I don't think the sanctions route is effective. Again, I'm just looking at it coldly about what works. I've lived through sanctions in Yugoslavia wars, and I also lived through them in Iraq. First of all, they enrich a corrupt class of sanctions busters. They create a whole new kind of criminal class which is connected to the government, and that becomes a strong promoter of domestic repression. Sanctions that cripple a country's leadership without harming the population are a little bit like a unicorn. It's a beautiful idea, but it doesn't really exist. So, to me, this idea that you can really hurt the regime and not hurt the people with targeted sanctions or heavy sanctions or whatever adjective you want to use is a fantasy. I actually think that this sanctions regime is being promoted in part by people who want to see a full break between the United States and Iran, because you always hear this second piece of the sanction argument. Okay, we're going to just use sanctions. It's the peaceful option. But if sanctions don't work, then we have to go to the next stage. But the sanctions are guaranteed not to work. And the people who are promoting them in many cases know this. So I have a great suspicion of the sanctions option. And besides, I don't think it's going to work. As for what would happen if the United States bombed Iran, I think you'd have an exaggerated version of what's going to happen with sanctions. Sanctions hurt ordinary people. People in countries don't blame their regime for the effects of sanctions, which is our fantasy. They blame the people that impose the sanctions. I think if the United States bombs Iran, or an ally of the United States bombs Iran, you're going to see the same response that happens in every country that comes under attack. Everybody unites behind the regime. It happened here after September 11th. George Bush's popularity was 85%, and it's perfectly reasonable. I actually think that this has also occurred to President Ahmadinejad. He knows that he's very unpopular. There's only one way that he can become very popular in Iran. And not only that, he has these fantasies about being the new Saladin, the hero of the entire Islamic world. There's only one way that he can achieve that, and that is by being attacked by the United States or Israel. Then he could be the great martyr. And I sometimes think that he's thinking to himself, what could I do to provoke this kind of attack? Keep pushing the nuclear program, say that there was no Holocaust, say that you're going to bomb Israel, see if I can't get them to bomb me. Once they bomb me, I'll become popular. And I think that's a very effective strategy. It's not far-fetched. It's the only way people would unite behind him. And I do think they would. I think Iranians who don't like their government will support their government if their country is bombed by a foreign power. It's just an immutable law that affects people in every country. As I said, there's great popular support and sympathy in Iran for the United States. This is a strategic asset we can't waste. If we bomb them, it's gone. I'd say another thing. There are about 5,000 nuclear scientists in Iran. Now, if we can target our bombs to make sure we kill all 5,000 of them, we might have achieved something. But I don't think that's possible. You can't bomb knowledge. You can't bomb the knowledge out of people's heads. Now, if people are afraid that Iran might pass nuclear secrets on to terrorist groups, just bomb the houses of the nuclear scientists and kill their wives and children. Then see what incentive they have to start collaborating with militant anti-American groups. We are only intensifying the long-term danger. And this fits into a classic American paradigm. And it's the same thing that happened when we confronted the Mossadegh challenge. We look for a short-term solution. And we can do this. We can achieve it. We have the military power to blow up a lot of nuclear plants, just like we had the power to overthrow Mossadegh. That's easy. But the long-term effects wind up being tremendously harmful to our own national security. Right now, one of the reasons why Iran is so eager to have nuclear potential goes back to the Iran-Iraq war. You know that Iraq attacked Iran with poison gas. We were selling Iraq the helicopters at that time. Those helicopters were then used to dump poison gas in violation of international law on Iran. Now, when Iran complained, not only did the United States reject that complaint, we worked at the United Nations to assure that there would be no investigation of the poison gassing. And then American leaders stated in public that they suspected that Iran had gassed their own people in order to gain international sympathy. So what does this make the Iranians think? It makes them think, we have been the victim of attacks by unconventional weapons, by weapons of mass destruction. And when we tried to complain, we were not allowed to do so. The West organized it so that we were never able to get justice. This, I think, is part of the motivation for them to think, we need unconventional weapons of our own. There's nothing that will unify Iranians around the idea we need nuclear weapons more than an attack from the outside. After all, why did we attack Saddam Hussein and we didn't attack North Korea? The difference is North Korea had nuclear weapons, and the Iranians are very aware of this. So I think an attack would eliminate all hesitation and all divisions within Iran on the question, should we have nuclear weapons or not?
On that note, we are going to open the floor to questions. I think there are microphones. Microphones. Okay. If anyone has a question, let me start over here with the nearest lady.
Yes. You said that any encouragement by America is the kiss of death. So what makes you think that the majority of Iranians are pro-American?
First of all, it wasn't just the guy that asked about Madonna. Public opinion surveys that have been taken by the Pew organization and other groups have sampled opinion throughout the Muslim world. And those surveys have shown intensely anti-American sentiment everywhere, except for Iran. It's a dramatic difference. And so the polling data that we have only reinforces the instinct that I think most Americans have who have gone there. I truly believe that despite history, there's a tremendous sympathy for the United States in Iran. And I repeat, there's no other Muslim country that has a sympathy for American ideals that's this intense. I think they support American ideals more than we do. So everything we know from what may be imperfect polling data, although these are polls that have been taken repeatedly and they're contrasted with polls taken in other countries, reinforces what most of us find when we go there. I'll tell you one little story. I met a guy outside the American embassy, former American embassy in Tehran. So this embassy is painted still with slogans that say, down with America, and we down with the great Satan, and so forth. And I met this guy in the square out there, and he has taken on a personal mission, self-appointed. Every time he sees a foreigner taking pictures of this scene, any Americans that go there, there are a few Americans that go. I'm leading a tour to Iran myself in May. So a few Americans do go there, and outsiders. They all want to go and take a picture of that scene, the embassy with these anti-American slogans. And this guy has taken it upon himself to go over to everybody that he sees doing that. And, of course, they first immediately think that he's a policeman, and he's going to yell at them for taking a picture. But instead he says, please don't take this picture. Please don't think this is what we believe. We don't believe this. This is just some old guys. That's from 25 years ago. Nobody believes this anymore. We love you. We don't feel like you're the great Satan. Please don't think that this picture represents the reality of Iran. Now, that's just one guy, but I do think he represents a broad consensus, certainly among the democratic movement in Iran.
First, thank you for your work. The question relates to, one, you had mentioned that you thought that we could engage them and that there are some issues that they had, similar to the Chinese had, although Trudy said part of the problem was there is this confusion of what they are. One, could you mention those kinds or one or two or three things that you think the Iranians want? And the second thing is, how do we in this country begin to have discussions where politicians can have these discussions about entertaining what are the ideas or things that Iran wants?
In 2003, and an episode that nobody knew about at the time, the Iranians made a very dramatic gesture to the United States. Through the Swiss ambassador in Tehran, who was the official representative of U.S. interests in Iran, they made an offer to negotiate. And it was a remarkably detailed offer. We have the text now. And they explained what they wanted from the U.S., but they also explained what they would be willing to give. So here's what they said they would give would be they would be open to discussing what they called complete transparency in our nuclear program and an end to all material support for militant groups, including specifically named Hamas, Hezbollah, and Islamic Jihad. And the transformation of Hezbollah into, quote, a mere political party. Now, what did they ask from the United States? An end to international isolation, recognition of the legitimate security interests of Iran, and access to the world, including the World Trade Organization, technology, and other international organizations. What I think Iran wants is a recognition of what I see as an evident reality, that Iran is a regional power. Now, during the Bush administration, it was a taboo, and this was specifically told to Bush administration officials, to mention the phrase legitimate security interests or even security interests of Iran. It could not be that Iran had legitimate security interests. Anything that was in the security interest of Iran was thought to be subversive and bad for everybody else, so therefore illegitimate. As for the climate in Washington, now every time I go to Washington, which is as infrequently as possible, I am impressed with how narrow are the options that are acceptable for discussion. Any germ of original thinking, of new ideas, is treated as the beginning of some frightful plague that must be stamped out immediately before it infects the entire policymaking process. It reminds me of this story I once read about Tallulah Bankhead. Apparently, she went to see a show on Broadway with some other diva, some other actress on stage, and after the show, she was asked, "So how did you like her performance?" And Tallulah replied, "She ran the gamut of emotions from A to B." That's something like the policy options that we consider in Washington. There's a tremendous pressure in the foreign policy establishment to keep the options very, very narrow. And I think, I mean, it's pretty impressive to me how quickly and fully this establishment consensus overtook even the Obama administration. So how do you break out of that probably is a question for people that have more experience in Washington than I do. I think those of us on the outside can do what little we can. I'm trying to beat my spoon on the high chair and try to promote some new thinking in Washington. But, again, I go back to a point I made earlier. When it comes to dealing with Iran, the United States is still a prisoner of emotion. We're so angry at Iran. The idea is they've hit us several times in very devastating ways, and we haven't hit them back. And therefore, it wouldn't be right to negotiate with them until we've brought them down to size a little bit. This is just kind of a feel-good approach that actually undermines our own security interests. So if we could just find a way to separate the anti-Iran emotions, then I think we could get somewhere. But maybe part of the problem is that the people who are now at the pinnacle of the foreign policy establishment are people who were shaped in their younger years by the Iran hostage crisis, and they still see Iran through that lens. So maybe the biological solution is the only one.
Oh, let me just add one word here. I was in Iran in 2003, and in fact the Swiss ambassador outlined this whole document to me, but I didn't fully appreciate what I was hearing at the time because there was no actual document available then. He was just saying that there might be this possibility. Subsequently, first of all, the document became available much later. But subsequently, I got to know some of the people on the Iranian side who had worked on it. And, you know, to be right up front about it, it was an opportunity missed. However, this was not an official document. It was a feeler document. And what the people who worked on the draft told me was that they had an 85% green light from Ayatollah Khamenei, but that other 15% they didn't know if they could ever get. And the 15% included crucial items such as whether Iran's policy towards Israel would change, because what was in the document was the statement that whatever was acceptable to the Palestinians would be acceptable to Iran. And, you know, you have to sort of think back, 2003, well, the peace process had already gone off the rails, but it wasn't nearly so far off the rails as it is now. So if you fast forward to now, on the one hand, I believe that certain people in the Obama administration envisioned that you could have a broader peace. You could certainly question, and you have, who the administration then put in charge of the policy. It was not the creative thinkers. But to be fair to the Obama administration, much has changed in Iran. The people who put together this document were all people who were either associated with President Khatami or, in one case, with Rafsanjani. Both of those figures wanted this deal. Now the people in power are the Revolutionary Guards, of the type who said to me, "You need us more than we need you." In the letter that President Obama sent early on to Ayatollah Khamenei, there were intimations of the idea of there would be security guarantees. We do not want to overthrow your regime. So I certainly think conceptually this was out there. I don't think you would get that kind of document coming out of the Iranian side now that you got then, because all of those people are now in the opposition and, shall we say, being treated rather rudely, and that's being kind. So things have gotten much tougher. I agree that creativity was needed, but I think there's so much division on the Iranian side that, you know, we've reached this bad moment in time. I can't say that I know what would happen if there was creativity on the U.S. side, but certainly the initial overtures from President Obama were not the direct ones, were not greeted with any warmth. Neither side trusts each other at all. That moment in 2003, you know, sticks in my mind, and, you know, it may be one of those lost opportunities in history that it will be hard to roll back the film.
One of the odd, sad parts about this relationship is that there have been moments when each side has been ready to talk, but not at the same time.
Right, right. Let me get somebody all the way in the back. There's a lady in black, I believe, in the center. Yes, you.
Hi. Thanks a lot, both of you, for your very good work. And my father actually installed all the satellite communications in Iran in the 70s, so I know a little bit more about Iran than most Americans. And I totally agree with you that the sentiment of the people is very pro-American. Now, this was back in the 70s, but they're very warm, generous people anyway. And it occurs to me that it would just take a modicum of empathy in foreign relations to open up the dialogue with the Iranians. And I'm wondering why this hasn't been done. Specifically, I'm thinking of the letter that Ahmadinejad wrote to George W. Bush, which George W. Bush totally ignored. And I'm wondering why Ahmadinejad wrote the letter and what serves Bush and even the Obama administration to ignore those types of overtures.
As I said, I think there were powerful forces on both sides that want to keep these countries apart. It's in the interests of militants on both sides that there be no rapprochement. I agree with Trudy that it's hard to tell what's on the other side. The Iranian government is quite opaque, and even if you could understand it fully, that would only be today. By tomorrow, it might be different. So we don't really know what's going on behind those closed doors. I would just say this. We can't control their response to us, but we can control what we say to them. So I'd like to see what would happen if we made the offer, if we opened up and put aside our emotions and tried to think clearly about national interests. Now, it might not produce anything. I do think that in the long run, it would strengthen people who are favoring democracy and change in Iran, even if there were no response. If Iranians come to realize that the United States really did make a serious, broad, honest effort to negotiate with the Iranian regime, and the regime didn't do it, that, I think, also would add to the momentum of the democratic movement, even if it didn't produce anything. But I still feel that the policy process in Washington is, as Trudy suggested, in the hands of people who are not committed to breaking out of the paradigm. Why that is has to do more with Washington than with America. And I have to say that although in many years as a foreign correspondent I've come to know quite a bit about the politics of many countries, the United States is not one of them.
Thank you, Mr. Kinzer. I I'm one of your admirers, as you know.
Let me just introduce our guest. When Mohammad Mossadegh was prime minister of Iran, the mayor of Tehran was the father of this lady. And this heroic figure in Iran who just passed away a few months ago was Mossadegh's private lawyer for the rest of his life, for the next 15 years, and was one of the very few people that was able to see Mossadegh freely all those years when he was under house arrest. So this question, whatever it's going to be, is not coming from somebody who is unfamiliar with this conundrum.
Thank you. Thank you. Actually, if I may, if you allow me, I would like to make a comment before the question. It's very hard for me as an Iranian, especially coming from a background that I come from, to say this. But I have to say this because of this audience, most of you, majority are Americans, that, you know, we Iranians always blame someone else for everything that happens to us. And I think that we have to look at our history. Yes, there was a coup d'etat in Iran, and the CIA was involved. In fact, I blame the British much more than the Americans. I just came back from London looking at the documents at the PRO, and the British embassy from Tehran sends telegrams after telegrams to the State Department, do not give money, because Mossadegh had asked for a loan from the Americans. Do not give him any money. On August 19th, the coup d'etat happens. On August 23rd, there's a telegram from the British embassy to the State Department. Now go ahead and give the money to the newly general that took over the government from Mossadegh. So I actually blame the British much more than American. But, you know, I want to emphasize this, that this is very important in the discussion of negotiations between Iran and the U.S., present negotiations. The Iranian government asked for an apology, you know, from the U.S. Madeleine Albright gave an apology. Obama has given an apology. But it's not enough for them. I think they are looking, I don't know what they're looking for, but they're looking for something, you know, beyond imagination. And even if the U.S. government decides to give many, many credits or, you know, options to Iran, as long as the supreme leader and people like Ahmadinejad are in power, I do not believe that they're going, because they know that once they open up, then it's the end of them. So, you know, I would like to know your opinion about that. And also, this is very important for people in this audience to know that, and I think that Stephen also agrees with me, if it weren't for the bribed Iranians around Mossadegh, the members of the Majlis who were bribed by the British government, and the money that was poured in the streets of Tehran, given to Iranians, the infamous coup d'etat of 1953 would have never happened. So as an Iranian, I think that we Iranians should take responsibility for our own actions and for our own deeds. And that's also true about today's negotiations.
Well, thank you so much. I think that in one way we're very much in line, and that is both of us believe that the country that we're from, who we are, should look inside ourselves. It's your challenge to look at Iran's responsibility. It's not our challenge to point a finger at Iran. It's our, as Iranians look inside themselves and ask themselves what they did to help create their present crisis, Americans should also do the same. And I think this is true for individuals as well as it is for governments. I mean, when you're an adult, you realize it doesn't do any good when you get into trouble to think about that jerk that caused all that trouble for me. You can't control that other person. Ask yourself, what did I do to help create this bad situation? I can't control other people, but I can control me. So I think the Americans in this audience have to look at our own role, both in the past and today. And I think it's wonderful if Iranians are doing the same thing. I think maybe the democratic movement in Iran is an expression of this view that we need not to keep blaming other people and looking for help from other people. This is our problem. We helped create it, and we need to find a way out of it. And for Americans, I think our job is to respect the motivations of that very profoundly impressive democratic movement. Thank you for coming.
And on that note, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. I was told that that's the last question. So thank you all for coming, and thank you, Stephen Kinzer.
That was great, Trudy. Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.